the problem for NATO from a military point of view is this. If it turns into a conventional fight between the Russian army and NATO, the Russian army will win. I don't think there's any serious doubt about that. They're much better trained. They're much better organised. Their equipment is better. Therefore, the temptation for NATO to go nuclear at an early stage of the game will always be there. The Russians, I think, have seen this and have actually modernised their nuclear forces so that they are in a position to second strike anyway. I mean, just think about it. You know, if you've got a nuclear submarine, a Russian nuclear submarine lurking around in the Atlantic, they can incinerate Washington if they need to.
There's also another something called the S-500 Prometheus defence systems, which are designed to take out these intercontinental ballistic missiles that actually travel through space. So it seems there's quite a lot of attention being paid in Russia to anti-ballistic missile systems.
Well, of course, because if you've got anti-ballistic missiles, that's what the ABM Treaty of 1972 was supposed to get rid of. Because once people start trying to shoot the other side's missiles down, they're then working towards the capacity for a first strike. And that's true both in China and in Russia. Now, the West has openly pursued the capacity to make a first strike against Russia and China. Now, the Russian and Chinese leaderships, not being stupid, can see what that means. Ordinary people in the West have been bamboozled that, oh, we'll only shoot their missiles down if they shoot at us. But NATO has never said that it's never going to use nuclear weapons first. They want to put the Russians and the Chinese in a position where they can be threatened with being nuked, very quickly, and that they won't be able to respond, because if they try and respond, their missiles will then be shot down. This is all Dr. Strangelove stuff, because even a minor nuclear exchange is likely to devastate human civilization. And why are we wasting time and energy on building these wretched weapons instead of trying to reduce tensions and build a better world for us all? I'm afraid it's because capitalism, in its final phases, becomes an extremely anti-human system. And ultimately, we are going to have to defeat capitalism, or capitalism is going to defeat us.
So in what role does the G8 in Bavaria play in all this?
G7.
Sorry, because the Russians were kicked out, weren't
well,
they?
Well, the G7 in Bavaria will be a, the Americans will be trying to whip everybody into line for the various policies they want to pursue, the trade and investment partnership, the threats against Russia, the threats against China, etc. And then the Bilderberg will be possibly where the real movers and shakers will get together.
Well, this is the interesting thing, isn't it?
Because usually they're the other way around, aren't they?
Every year, the Bilderberg conference happens a little bit before the G7, yeah. Just a week or so before, a couple of weeks before, somewhere in North America or Europe, in one of the NATO countries. Yeah. But this time, there's a few differences. It's happening the week after, and it's also happening in a supposedly neutral country, Austria.
Yes, well, the Austrians, in fact, are not actually... They've got a conservative government in Austria, I believe, but they're not entirely happy about this confrontational approach towards the Russians, because Austria is neutral. It's not actually part of NATO. And what's actually happened within Europe is a split, not an east-west split, but a north-south split. The northern European countries are basically more up the backside of the Americans for historical and cultural reasons. The southern European countries, whether it's Hungary or Austria or Greece or Spain or Portugal, who, don't forget, many southern European countries had NATO-backed military dictatorships in our lifetimes. They don't see the world in quite the same way as Middle England. Why should they?
What are your thoughts about the choice of Austria, though? Because I know, you've said on this show before, you've talked about this South Stream pipeline, yeah, and the fact that this is actually a bit of a clinch point between East and West, yeah, at the moment.
Well, the Austrians are quite happy to have a South Stream pipeline. It makes a lot of sense to have gas coming from Russia, which doesn't have to go through Ukraine, which is basically a shambolic mess at the best of times, and it can turn the taps off at any time just to exert pressure. But I imagine that the Americans have presumably decided to have, and the British have decided to have these meetings where they are, so that they can put pressure on the Austrians to get into line. I would imagine that's probably what it is.
Also, we've got the G7 taking place in Germany. Revelations just a few weeks ago from The Intercept, the site that Glenn Greenwald and others contribute to, that Ramstein in Germany, a US base in Ramstein, is actually the key hub of the world drone assassination program. And I just put it to you that the idea that you can kill someone with a Hellfire missile on a drone in Yemen, in Afghanistan or Pakistan or anywhere, you know, virtually with impunity, sitting in a little computer console somewhere in a British airbase or a US airbase or Israeli airbase, is a war crime. And this is a very serious really move that the West is actually advancing into really upping the arms race in an unacceptable way.
Well, they're basically going to war with humanity. and we'll see what the outcomes will be. Things are very dangerous, because when people are losing power or fear losing power, they become incredibly kind of reckless. We're sleepwalking, actually. We're sleepwalking towards disaster here, both economically and politically.
But we're not just sleepwalking, are we? We're being sort of nudged along.
Well, that's right. You are feeling sleepy, sleepy. When I snap my fingers, we will go to war with Russia.
US, EU and Russian political power does pivot around that part of Europe. I mean, I'm looking specifically, I suppose, at the just across the border in Switzerland, in Basel, from where all this is taking place. You've got it in southern Germany, in Austria, and then just across the border in Switzerland as well is the Bank for International Settlements. Now, we've had this Swiss role in the FIFA scandal, which is the Swiss police doing these arrests. Well, actually, the United States was very, very close to the Swiss, and the Nazis were in the Second World War, and particularly at the end, because we know that the Bank for International Settlements, which the Bretton Woods Conference attempted to close down, was providing a lot of the finance for the Nazi Party and for Hitler's war machine. And also, they said that they wanted to close this BIS down, but they didn't. It's now actually at the centre of a lot of world banking regulation. And Mark Carney was the chair of the regulation committee at the BIS in Switzerland. I mean, we sold this kind of myth that the present governor of the Bank of England was from Canada, from the Bank of Canada. Actually, he was a key person at the BIS. So just tell us a bit about the BIS in Switzerland and how powerful it is controlling the Western banking system, which, of course, has been, over the last few years, since 2008, caused a total disaster, and with impunity, with no prosecutions.
Well, it's very opaque what goes on at that level. Let's put it that way. Montague Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, famously used the BIS to remove the Czech Republic's gold supply to the Germans after they'd invaded. They got their gold supply in the BIS. And Montague Norman, in 1939, when Germany invaded Czechoslovakia, insisted that the BIS supply the Nazi regime that had taken over in Czechoslovakia with the Czech gold, because otherwise business would be undermined. And the view of Montague Norman, the head of the Bank of England, was that wars come and go, but business goes on forever. And I think that just about sums up the role of the banking system in the geopolitical crisis that we're in. They want war because it preserves their power and their assets. Many of them are definitely criminals. I mean, that's one thing that did come out of these trials of the bankers in the US and elsewhere in the last few weeks. They are definitely criminals. They pleaded guilty. They should have been sent to prison and their assets should have been seized. And of course, if they start doing things like that, then deficits start to become much more manageable.
Now, I mentioned at the top of the hour this group, the Illuminati, also based in Bavaria, and they did have a famous conference in 1782. I mean, we're going back a long, long way here, in Wilhelmsbad, where these various different branches of Freemasonry right across Europe, including, for example, Grand Orient in France, which was an atheist version of Freemasonry, in Britain, the York Rite and other branches were supposedly, anyway, Christian versions of Freemasonry. But this event in 1782 brought all of these under the governing body called the Illuminati, based in Bavaria. One of the things, I was just digging into this, and actually when the Bavarian government very first discovered that this organization, this secret society, was meeting, they managed to get some leaks of the plans that they had to take over the government of Bavaria and of Germany, and also to take over the German religious bodies. They arrested people. Some of them went to jail, but most of them basically just lost their jobs and that kind of thing. I was quite fascinated to discover that it was Ernst II, the Duke of Saxe-Gotha, in Bavaria, who actually sheltered Weishaupt, the founder of this movement. And, of course, his ancestors are the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family that are now the British royal family. So it seems that there is a sort of, families that have been elitist families for centuries, Martin.
I think there's no doubt about it that the elite tends to self-perpetuate in any society. That's a truism. I don't know how helpful it is to go as far back as that, because it then leaves people saying, well, you can't really suggest. Nobody that was alive in 1782 is alive today. The thing that the time horizon, which I think is more relevant, is the lifetime, our lifetimes, and recent.
I think
history.
The point I'm trying to make, rather than is that actually these families are very, very concentrated. Their minds are very concentrated on holding on to their wealth, and they see a lot of the left wing, particularly communism, as a threat to that, taking their wealth off them. They would much rather spend their life playing golf than have to go to work for a living.
Well, indeed, indeed, and you know, families like the Rothschilds clearly have been at the centre of banking power for centuries. Now, no doubt about it.
Now
they themselves would admit so.
I mean, there's two things we've been talking about tonight, which the Rothschilds most definitely were involved in. One is the sacking of Alistair Milne, who was Seamus Milne's father, who was Director General of the BBC, Victor Rothschild, back in 1987. And then there's also the their attendance and involvement in the Bilderberg conferences. So you've got this kind of European banking network of the Rothschilds. In the United States, you've got the Rockefellers, who were originally an oil company, oil family, and then they realised actually banking seems to be a lot more lucrative.
Well, what tends to happen in elite politics is if you can't beat them, join them. So you get conflict between different elite groups, but ultimately they tend to club together to protect their collective privileges from the rest of society. And, you know, it's what Robert Michel's used to call the iron law of oligarchy a long time ago. And, as a 19th century social scientist. People shouldn't be surprised about this. The world has always been run by the powerful. It still is.
It seems like almost a sort of capitalist version of the feudal system, where it's not about what whether you're a king, a prince, a princess, a duke, a marquis, or a marchioness, or whatever. You're actually, it's all about how much money you've got in the bank and how much power you've got and what boards you're on.
Well, what tends to happen is various forms of elite power become fused. So the obvious thing that bankers and industrialists did in 19th century Britain is they married aristocrats, and then the children are both bankers, industrialists, and aristocrats.
Okay, what about this? The significance, though, of the Bilderberg being after the G7? I mean, I certainly look at that and I think, well, actually, most of the time, the Bilderberg is having a discussion and it's kind of tweaking and the tweaking policy, seeing which of the elites around Europe and North America, which policies they're going to go for and which not. Although I think there's also a large aspect of the Bilderberg conference, which is bringing in people who are on the fringes of power to sort of schmooze them. Also, of course, looking at up-and-coming new politicians. I'm not sure if it's Harriet Harman's going to be there, but, you know, well, people who are in
up-and-coming,
powerful, who are in a position maybe to take over or to succeed someone else in a large, powerful opposition party. But the idea that Bilderberg conference is taking place after G7, for some reason, I look at this and I think, well, actually, maybe the final plans for what's going to happen in the next year or so in regards to a lot of NATO's foreign policy, military policy, possibly economic technology policy, is actually going to be made at Bilderberg rather than G7.
Well, it's hard to know exactly what the significance is. I think it is significant that Bilderberg normally is the place where they coordinate before they end up at the G7, which is a more public event. So the way they're doing it the other way around this time, it's very suspicious.
Well,
it could well be.
We know Westminster's a sideshow. It looks like even the G7 is becoming a sideshow.
Well, indeed. And so what may be happening is that they are preparing a full-on confrontation with Russia for the end of the year, as the markets collapse, because they may well do in the next week or so when the Greeks don't pay their debts.
Okay, well, how does this actually fit then with the economic situation? I mean, we've got all these sort of potential crises on the horizon. We've had them for many years, but in a way you get kind of crisis fatigue, don't you?
Yes.
But they're certainly there. So you've got an economic crisis, you've got the climate crisis. Let's just set that aside for a moment. But looking at the economic crisis and the crisis with Ukraine, the potential war there.
Syria, don't forget Syria.
And Syria, which I think those are both definitely related, because it's about the Russian Black Sea Fleet and their access to the Mediterranean, a lot of what's been going on in Crimea anyway. So, I mean, what are your thoughts about the timing of those two possible crises? And maybe that's the sort of thing that the people like the Bilderbergs are talking about.
I think that is exactly what they're talking about. They are trying to get all their ducks in a row to carry out the political démarche that they want to carry out, which is essentially to use war to cover up their failures in global economic policy.
It's getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.